Reyes. We will continue with the protocol used yesterday, 30 minutes to a side, including, of course, the judges going in order of seniority. Is the appellant ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
The government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Good morning. Chief Judge, members of the court, may it please the court, I'm Major Ben Acinelli and I represent the appellant specialist Marco Reyes. Your Honor, I'd ask for 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Three?
Yes, sir.
Granted.
Thank you. Your Honor, in this case, the government did not act to take immediate steps to try a soldier they chose to place into pretrial confinement. And when that happens, Article 10 contemplates only one remedy, and that's dismissal with prejudice. And that's precisely what this court should order here. The government chose to put Specialist Reyes into confinement on July 31st, 2015. They preferred charges against him 1 week later, and those same charges were eventually tried at court-martial some 450 days later. That demonstrates the lack of immediate steps taken by the government in this case, and the lack of reasonable diligence holistically throughout the process. Charges were originally referred against him in December 2015, but it still took an additional 10 months to bring him to trial, and there's no reason it should have taken that long. There was initial delay at the fault of the government. The defense correction submitted its first offer to plead guilty in December of 2015. However, the prosecution refused to show that offer to the convening authority absent a signed stipulation of fact, which the defense only agreed to do if the convening authority accepted that offer to plead guilty, which never happened. Moreover, they notified the government that same month in December that they needed experts in, amongst other things, forensic psychiatry and Spanish translation. But 5 months later, when it came to trial time in April, those experts had still not been procured, and the government requested additional delay. And then turning to the last period of delay in August.
Counsel, get closer to the microphone. I'm having trouble hearing you.
Turning to the last 2 months in August and October, both of those delays were engendered by late government disclosures. And contrary to the government's argument that the judge's remedy cures any prejudice here, the fact the judge needed to suppress, at least in the case in chief, some of that evidence is evidence of lack of reasonable diligence. In October of 2016, the government was still originally turning over witness statements they received in September of 2015. Overall, there was a lack of reasonable diligence throughout the process. Article 10 has been violated, and this court should dismiss the charges.
Thank you, counsel. One observation on this case, nobody seemed to want to try this case, except maybe the staff judge advocate to the convening authority. What's going on here? You got six offers to plead. You've got no Article 10 motion until 6 months go by. What's going on here? I wish I knew, but neither side seemed particularly interested in getting this case tried.
Well, Your Honor, there was certainly a lot of back and forth early on between the parties.
Early on and late?
Yes, Your Honor. But I would point this court to the April motion to dismiss for a Sixth Amendment speeding trial violation, where it appears the defense was fully prepared to go to trial on 8 of the 9 sexual assault allegations, as well as many of the other numerous charges.
Well, there was at least one situation in which the government said, okay, with the government said, okay, we'll be ready on date X. And the accused said, oh, well, we'll be
Yes, Your Honor. Part of our argument is that it shouldn't be so hard to find an expert in forensic psychiatry. I mean, the Department of Defense employs hundreds of them. Has there been a more rigorous search when initially requested or when the judge compelled it in early February? It's the defense's position that they would have found one for the April trial date, and this case would have and should have gone to trial in April.
Thank you, counsel. Judge Ryan.
Yes, counsel, as I understand the stipulation of facts that you entered into with the government on 19 October 2016, the charges referred on December 10th of 2015, and the defense immediately said it was not available for trial until May 9th of 2016. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Secondly, on the 4/18/2016 withdrawal, where the charges were drawn and transferred to a different commander and re-referred, it appears in the papers that the defense agreed to that withdrawal and re-referral. Is that correct?
I don't know that they agreed or disagreed. My reading of the record, Your Honor, was that the government simply did that and the defense agreed to keep the pre-scheduled trial dates.
Okay, well, the military judge, in her rendition of things, said that the police appears that the defense did not contest that withdrawal and transfer.
They did not challenge the withdrawal and re-referral.
So they did not oppose it?
They did not object, Your Honor.
I have no further questions.
Judge Olson.
Good morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Some circuit courts say that a motion to dismiss because of a prior alleged speedy trial violation should not be viewed as the same as a speedy trial demand for the future. In this instance, it seems consistent with what the chief judge was talking about. It seems as if the trial defense counsel was pointing backwards to past incidences rather than saying, we want to go to trial right now. Should that distinction make a difference to this court?
Your Honor, I don't think it should for two reasons. The first one is they did file an April speedy trial request indicating they're ready to go forward on almost all the serious charges in this case. And the second is that Article 10 is flipped from the Sixth Amendment. So the Sixth Amendment gives an accused the right to a speedy trial, but Article 10 places the burden on the government to take immediate steps. And so we do think that's the distinction that matters in this case.
Okay, can I turn your attention to the issue of prejudice here? You know, looking at issues such as preventing oppressive pretrial confinement, minimizing appellant's anxiety, and limiting the impairment of the defense in preparation. Where do you find the prejudice in this particular case?
Your Honor, we find the prejudice, although it's not required under Supreme Court precedent, and I don't think Article 10 necessarily requires it, but we find the prejudice in the particularized anxiety and concern of having counsel for 9 months and then triggering a delay where that counsel was forced to leave the installation, and Specialist Reyes rightly suffered more anxiety and concern about his looming need to IMC requests and things of that nature. And second, we note that the parties agreed at trial, when it finally happened, to 90 days of pretrial punishment credit, Article 13 credit. So although they did not discuss what it was on the record, it is clear there was some agreed-upon legal pretrial punishment that occurred, and that goes to the oppressive pretrial incarceration.
Okay, I assume my time is up, so I defer.
Thank you. Judge Sparks.
Good morning, Major Acinelli. I want to thank you for joining us, and you've got a very well-written brief here. But I have no questions, and I'm happy to cede my time back to either counsel or over to Judge Maggs, however the chief judge wishes.
Thank you, Judge Sparks. Judge Maggs.
Good morning, Major Acinelli. I ask you if you could respond to one of the points that the government makes in its brief. The government waited until the government secured the expert, and therefore, I guess that not all of the delay associated with securing the experts was the government's fault. What's your response to that argument by the government?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it tells us anything one way or the other. It seems perfectly reasonable to me to require expert consultants, as the military judge found at the motions hearing, to consult with them, to learn information about forensic psychiatry that the defense counsel simply don't know, and then say, all right, good, I'm not going to need you for trial. Thank you for your service. I don't have more money. Thank you for your time.
Okay. And let me ask a second question. This also goes to the question of prejudice. Does the appellant have an argument, or are you making an argument that the government delays specifically harm the trial preparation of the defense? I mean, often the delays would make it easier to prepare for trial.
Your Honor, my understanding of the record is that the motions below primarily lead on present pretrial incarceration and particular anxiety concern with regard to the court Barker factor.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Counsel, didn't he end up with the defense counsel he had, despite
Despite her PCS, his IMC request was eventually approved, and he did have the same lead counsel that he
had. All right, so what's the problem? He worried about it?
That is part of the problem, Your Honor, yes, is that it is. That you
well,
have
number one, is there anything in the record that says that? And number two, I'm very sorry he worried about it, but he wasn't harmed. You got the same counsel. So where does that leave us? You've already said that the trial prep wasn't impeded. Now we're back on, well, he was worried.
Your Honor, he did testify at the August motion hearing to the particular anxiety and concern, which is one of...
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Go ahead.
Your Honor, he did testify as to particularized anxiety and concern during the August Article 10 motion.
Okay.
So we do rest some of our brief upon that. But again, that is only a small subset of the congressional question of did the government take immediate steps, and we stand by the answers no. And we would highlight that Article 10 is different than many of the other articles because in it, Congress has warranted a remedy. Right, they say immediate steps or dismissal. It's very different than Article 12 or 13, which just says don't do these things.
So let's talk about immediate steps. What is your view with respect to the time during which the parties were pursuing the notion of a plea agreement? To whom do you believe that time is attributable?
I believe that... the delay in sending the offer to plead guilty to the convening authority that ultimately disapproved it is attributable to the government.
Which period delay specifically are you talking about? From what date to what date?
Specifically talking about the delay from the first offer to plead guilty in December until the January 28th date that the government sent a stipulation of facts to the defense.
So it's your view then that a trial counsel could not say that with your plea of guilty you need to propose a stipulation of facts?
I think they can say that the convening authority will not accept an offer to plead guilty with that in it, but until that offer is accepted, there is no triggering mechanism for the defense to have to sign a stipulation of facts. This is a prime example of the waste that it causes.
Okay, well, I guess I committed a lot of errors when I was a trial counsel because I wouldn't propose plea agreements without a stipulation of facts. Moving on to that, what period of time specifically do you say that the government did not do anything, that there was not forward motion with respect to this trial? And I understand you're not happy with how long it took them to find an expert. You're not happy with how long it took the plea agreement. But during what period of time specifically you say that nothing happened, that there was no forward motion?
Well, there is certainly no forward motion from at least April to August. And there is, again,
Well, April, but you had said that you weren't going to be ready to go to trial, right, until June 6th?
I believe the initial date request was May, Your Honor, but it's clear to me that in the party that they were, in fact, ready to go to trial in April. They were ready to try to go to trial in April on everything except for the one victim that they had asked the forensic psychiatrist for. So on nearly all of the charges, the defense was ready in April, and had they had the forensic psychiatrist that the court had ordered a couple months prior, I don't think there's any reason to believe they would not have been properly prepared.
Do you have any evidence whatsoever that this delay was any delay that you were complaining of was occasioned by the government in order to secure an advantage, a tactical advantage of some sort or another?
It is clear from the October turnover of emails that they've had for over a year that there was negligence, but we are not alleging specific malicious bad faith, Your Honor.
Questions from other judges?
Yes, Chief, this is Judge Olson. I have a question. Following up on what Judge Ryan was talking about here, you were saying that the defense was ready to go to trial much earlier. What are we to make of the fact that when the military judge denied the defense's March 28th motion to dismiss, appellant didn't say, okay, we want to go to trial right now. The appellant agreed to a continuance all the way to the end of August. They agreed to that. And then, with the August 24th motion to dismiss, appellant agreed to a delay until October. Shouldn't it be a situation where trial defense counsel needs to say, no, I don't agree to that. I want to go to trial right now?
Well, Your Honor, it appears that they did want to go to trial in April based upon their, not their Article 10 motion, but their other speedy trial motion as a backup, that they're ready to go to trial on nearly every serious charge in this case. And it is also clear that the reason for the extensive delay to the end of August is to allow the lead counsel in this case to change his position.
Okay, but I think you're missing my point. My point is, if defense counsel says to a military judge, yes, I agree to this continuance, how can an appellate court then look backwards and say, gee, if there was a real problem here, the military judge should have recognized that there was issue. Doesn't the agreement to the continuance really undercut appellant's position here?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because the question is still what caused the delay. And the delay in April, the government asked for that one. It's true that the defense agreed to the date, but they certainly did not request that delay. And with regard to the August delay, what caused the delay was the government disclosing, hey, we have a lot of your client statements. And I don't think it's unreasonable to say you have to guess whether they have something really incriminating on in there before you advise your client whether he should testify or not. I think that naturally causes delay, and that cause is late disclosures from the government.
But was that discovery material, though, related to appellant's own misconduct? And if so, can that really be considered as part of Article 10 delays if it was appellant's own misconduct?
Your Honor, the government asserts that it's on misconduct. It appears that there may have been a no-contact order in place for some of limited subset of those calls, but the vast majority was not. It was simply, if appellant was in jail for over a year at the time they grabbed it, and had been making phone calls to various people.
Well, you complain in your motion about the fact that these taped recordings between appellant and witnesses, that somehow the government should have known about them and disclosed them earlier. How is that?
Your Honor,
does the government have a requirement to, like, ask every witness in the case? Has the accused been contacting you and trying to get you to not testify at trial, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, Your Honor, to the extent the government was ready for trial in April, absent the expert witness issue, I would expect they would have talked to a cooperating witness and say, hey, has anything changed? Anything like that? And I expect that hasn't made that disclosure to them in August, apparently. But if the government wants to seize that evidence, then it's free to do so, but it's going to cause delay. They could have simply questioned her about it. Isn't it true that, at trial, and this would have obviated the entirety of the issue?
Well, would have, could have, should have. The point is that they're not required to, and when this blew up in their face, that he had been violating a no-contact order. It was his own misconduct. It seems to me, as Judge Ryan points out, that how is that attributable to government?
I'm certainly not attributing his misconduct to the government, Your Honor.
Well, the delay occasioned by his misconduct.
But it's not misconduct for which he was charged, Your Honor. So it could have been...
Whoa! We're not talking uncharged misconduct here. We're talking the origin of delay. This is an Article 10 case.
Agreed, Your Honor.
So can I just ask one other question about this delay from Judge Bolton brought up from 4 April to 26 August? The stipulation of facts that you entered into, or the defense counsel entered in with the government, point number 114, JA320, says, on 4 April 2016, during an Article 39A session, the court placed on the record the new schedule for trial. Additionally, the court questioned the accused about the new trial date to ensure it was acceptable with the accused because he was in pre-trial confinement. The military judge set the trial from 26 August through 2 September 2016. So implicit in that,
yes,
isn't that, well, it's not the defense did not request a delay, the defense acquiesced to that continuance.
Are you there, counsel? Hello? Stop. Is anybody on the line? Hello?
I'm still on the line, Your Honor. I think it's the appellant counsel's phone.
What?
I think he said something. He was saying something about, can they hear me, and then he left.
Okay, I didn't even hear that. Okay. Hold it.
Major Ashenelli, I think I got cut off there.
Okay, are you back on?
I am, sir.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, so Judge Ryan, I know you asked about the appellant personally. The judge personally questioned the appellant. Our response would be that this court should not give that particularly much weight. He wasn't entitled to counsel. He had counsel, and counsel told him, if you want me to continue to be counsel, this is the way it's going to happen. So I do not afford it a lot of weight that the judge asked the appellant personally in this case for those reasons.
I understand. Thank you.
All right, counsel. Your time has expired, minus the 3 minutes for... I'm mistaken. Go ahead, counsel.
You have 3 minutes and 12 seconds left. We stopped the clock when you dropped off.
Yeah, when you dropped off. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. But pending further questions of the court, we ask this court to dismiss for violation of Article 10.
Any questions from other judges? If not, thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Yes, Your Honor. Chief Justice, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Jerry Marin, and I represent the United States. As a threshold matter, this court has a complete record before it, complying with the statutory command of Article 54 and the procedural command of RCM 1103. Withdrawn cases do not need a verbatim transcript. Only cases resulting in punishment necessitate that. Reyes, too, was a creature of a separate CNCO promulgated by a different convening authority. And when it resulted... Yes, ma'am.
Never mind. Sorry, I was breaking our rules. Never mind.
thank you.
Could you speak a little louder?
Yes, Your Honor. A verbatim record of Reyes 1 accomplishes nothing for appellant in his Article 10 assignment of error because everything was litigated anew. This claim, however, appellant's Article 10 claim, it fails. This is not a scenario in which an appellant languished away in a brig, unaware of the charges against him, precluded from confronting his accusers. Instead, time and again, appellant agreed to, requested, and even caused delays. Waiting 192 days to ever raise a speedy trial issue, he brandished Article 10 when he knew the government could not proceed, only to seek a contingent later once the government was ready. In August of 2016, despite three speedy trial motions up to that point, he requested a continuance until October over government objection, indicating that he was not ready to be tried after all. On the other hand, the government, charged with prosecuting these serious, complex offenses, proceeded with reasonable diligence. There were no periods of inactivity. They conducted a magistrate's review as to the appropriateness of pretrial confinement. They staffed six offers to plead guilty, gathering approval from appellant's chain of command and three separate victims, jockeying back multiple counteroffers from the convening authority. They sought out experts from all over the world, and even during October 2016, where the government's discovery practice was not textbook, the government's behavior lacked any malicious intent to impede the defense. There was no governmental indifference, and it did not result in a delay. The military judge rendered any possible error harmless and imposed multiple remedies, ensuring that the appellant faced no prejudice at trial. She also credited him day-for-day confinement off of his sentence. And so viewing these proceedings as a whole, taking into account all of the Barker v. Wingo factors, the factual explanation for the reasonable and justifiable delays weigh in favor of the government, and this court should affirm the judgment of the Army Court.
Thank you, counsel. I agree, I think, that there weren't a lot of periods of inactivity in this case. This case is not a case where nothing happened. This case is a case where there were continuous flurries of activity that ended up resulting in nothing. What was the government doing here? It sounded like the government wasn't particularly eager to try this thing. I don't understand what's going on here. And in particular, with respect to the expert witnesses, the government seems to have taken upon itself the responsibility to discover the expert witnesses that are satisfactory to the defense. The defense said, we want a forensic psychiatrist. The government didn't say, who do you want? They said, oh dear, we'll get it at any cost, no problem, and then scurried around for months trying to find him. I have to say that the observation by defense counsel that there's got to be a huge forensic psychiatrist floating around the U.S. military is probably the case. Plus, I can't imagine that a Spanish language translator would be that hard to find in North Carolina. But regardless of that, the government seems to have taken upon itself the whole burden of doing this when it's up to the defense to indicate who they want, and it's up to the government under order to pay for it. So what's going on there?
Yes, Your Honor, I'll respond in two parts. To address the first part of your question about generally what was the government doing, I think it's important to start by noting that the government leading up to arraignment complied with all the procedural requirements with the magistrate's review. The Article 32 took 28 days to publish. And then when they withdrew and dismissed and re-preferred anew everything following the Article 32 report.
Which wasn't necessary, but we'll go ahead.
Well, it might not have been necessary because the government could have preferred additional charges, but as this court said in Cooley, the government has the right, if not the obligation, to thoroughly investigate before proceeding to trial. And based off the 32 report who recommended preferring additional charges, the government has a preference, is complying with RCM's preference to try all known charges and offenses together at one time. So that was at least a reasonable explanation.
Counsel, I'm sorry, you keep fading out and fading back in. Could you stay closer to the microphone?
Yes, sir, I apologize.
Thank you.
And then following arraignment, if you look, Your Honor, the majority of the government's activity was in response to four offers to plead guilty following the 9 December arraignment leading up to the appellant's first motion to dismiss in February. And so that the complicated pretrial negotiations, as this court found in Wilson, is quite reasonable. The government here had to consult with three separate victims, one of whom was represented by a special victims counsel, coordinate with the chain of command. They notified the military judge. And so if you're to the extent appellant is concerned about the stipulation of fact and requiring that later, I would note that not until the defense notified the government that they had providency issues following their second offer to plead, did the government say, we're going to require a stipulation of fact?
Thank you. Your time is up. Thank you. My time is up, brother. Thank you. Judge Arata.
I just have a question, counsel, with respect to the forensic psychiatrist. Am I correct that the motion to grant the defense request for forensic psychiatrists wasn't granted until February 8th?
Correct, Your Honor.
And then the government contacted some, expert defense expert clearing house, is that correct? Major Affinato?
Your Honor, the very next day, the government contacted multiple forensic psychiatrists. They went through the USASOC headquarters at Fort Bragg. They went through the MedCom headquarters. They even consulted with the administrative assistant who's in charge of the DOD-wide list that has the name.
And then the defense expert and forensic regional consultant recommended someone to the government. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. My understanding is that the defense never asked for a specific request.
This was the defense expert forensic regional consultant, so it wasn't the defense counsel itself. The defense counsel did not request a particular individual, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But then the government contacted the defense expert and forensic regional consultant, Major Appendor?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then that person who works with defense counsel, I guess, recommended a particular person?
Yes, Your Honor. That person was not available, and so that major said, well, you know what, I have other people that may be available. Let me reach out to them for you. And then that also turned out to no one to be available.
And so there was no one local that was available?
Not only were there no one local, Your Honor, my understanding of the record and from the trial counsel's emails back and forth with the defense is even they looked at that DOD-wide list for forensic psychiatrists that were nationwide, and that person who's in charge of coordinating with them got back to the trial counsel and said, no, nobody is available for your currently scheduled trial date in April.
Okay, thank you.
Judge Olson.
Good morning, counsel. In the October 2016 ruling on the motion to dismiss by the military judge, when she was deciding making her findings of fact and conclusions of law, she cited to the Reyes 1 record. So because she made that reference to Reyes 1, the Reyes 1 record of trial on the record, does that mean that under RCM 1103B3B, that verbatim transcript of Reyes 1 needed to be attached to the record for appellate review?
No, Your Honor. And two reasons for that. The first is that because still Reyes 1 never resulted in a punishment. And so under RCM 1103 ECHO, the termination prior to findings, there still is no requirement for verbatim transcript. So what is on the record before this court now complies with RCM 1103. And the second reason is, although she cited to the point within Reyes 1 transcript, Your Honor, these facts are also found from two stipulations of facts that both parties agreed to and signed when they were litigating this Article 10 motion anew. And so it's not necessarily the content of what occurred on the record in the 39A of Reyes 1 that's important. It's the fact that the military judge denied the first motion to dismiss, and then following that, the appellant agreed to a later trial date. Those are the facts of consequence, and all parties agreed to the relevant substantial facts for the military judge to make her ruling for the October Article 10 motion here.
Okay, thank you. I have no further questions.
Judge Sparks.
Once again, counsel, I thank you for your submission. Chief Judge, I have no questions.
Thank you. Judge Maggs.
Good morning, Captain Marin. Let me ask you about a point that appellant makes in its reply brief. Appellant argues that that the government was acted improperly in refusing to show the offer to plead guilty to the convening authority unless it was accompanied by a stipulation of fact. The appellant argues that the government had no authority to do this. What's the government's response to that statement?
Your Honor, that's a perfectly legitimate way of doing business in terms of securing an offer to plead guilty. This is a particularly complex case with a charge sheet that's 6 pages long with over 30 specifications, and the appellant already had providency issues for his third offer to plead that he submitted on 26 January. And so when the government said, we are not going to present this to the convening authority without a stipulation of fact, that's absolutely reasonable, and it's something that it's a prerogative of the convening authority who's going to put a limit on the appellant's punitive exposure and to also ensure that there is a meeting of the minds for this offer to plead, that both sides understand exactly what the deal that the appellant is entering into with.
My second question concerns the point that the appellant makes in his reply brief that if the government wanted to know what Ms. Martinez and the appellant had communicated about or whether they had communicated, it could have exercised reasonable diligence and simply asked Ms. Martinez. And what's the government's response to that particular allegation, or particular argument, I should say?
Yes, Your Honor. Two points. The first is that it's important to remember that there was an offer to plead guilty locked in as of 16 May. And from May until he agreed to keep the trial date as of August, there were 5 months span there where they were locked into an offer to plead guilty where the appellant was going to plead guilty to the second charge on the charge sheet, which was conspiring with his co-conspirator to remove the stolen Xbox. And so the landscape changed significantly when the appellant backed out of his OTC completely in September of 2016. So my first point, I guess, Your Honor, is simply that there was no reason to go back to that co-conspirator to ask her these questions. And the second part about this is that this co-conspirator was a represented party. She was facing charges in the civilian sector and had a federal public defender. So it was not like the government had quick access to this witness. Our position is that the appellant did indeed have the notice of this ongoing accumulation of the telephone calls that he was making throughout confinement. So despite the government not learning about it until August when they did do that interview, which is a reasonable time period, it was the appellant making these telephone calls, so there could have been the surprise embedded within the jail telephone call data dump that appellant cited to as of August of 2016.
Thank you.
Thank you. All judges having completed, any judge may ask questions and counsel you may proceed.
I have a follow-up question to Judge Maggs' question about the authority of trial counsel if they acted on their own recognizance to not forward an offer to plead guilty without a stipulation of facts. And I say that because, you know, I mentioned earlier that, like, that was a requirement, but it was one that the convening authorities had agreed with me about. Does that make sense?
Yes,
it was not one that I, on my own, took upon myself. And so is it the case here that the trial counsel said, I'm not going to forward a offer to plead guilty to the convening authority because I want a stipulation of that?
Your Honor, I think the record is not quite clear to that, so in candor I have to say that I'm not certain as to the answer to your question, but I know two things that might be relevant. And the first is that I believe I cited in the footnote to my brief that the trial counsel had their own internal reviews with their supervisory chain of the actual stipulation of facts, and that's one part of the puzzle that they were working on in coordinating with these offers to plead guilty, which indicates that that stipulation of facts was running up the chain and that the SJA and thereby convening authority was aware of what was going on. And then the second thing, Your Honor, is it's not in the joint appendix, but in the record, the statute advocate wrote advice to the convening authority about which charges that the appellant was going to plead guilty to and which that he was not. And if my memory is correct, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe that a stipulation of fact was part of the enclosures that the SJA had with him when he discussed this offer to plead with the convening authority. So it does not appear to me, Your Honor, that the trial counsel in this case just took the initiative and said, no defense, we're not going to pass this up. It appears to be that was government action as a whole in consultation with the convening authority.
Via the statute advocate?
Yes, Your Honor.
Other questions for counsel? Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to note two points because, Chief Judge Judy, I don't think I finished answering your question in the beginning about the experts. And I know, Judge Maggs, you pointed to appellant releasing one of his experts. So I'd just like to draw this court's attention to April, where I don't believe that the second speedy trial motion under the Sixth Amendment is as helpful to the appellant as he asserts here for a couple of reasons. And the first is that no expert at the appellant's trial testified, and that the defense even agreed to a 12-day continuance to even litigate the expert. So it indicates that the defense was engaged in these ongoing negotiations, also hoping to secure a deal. And then within days of finding out that the offer to plead guilty had been disapproved, they dropped a speedy trial motion. And then within days of finding out that they couldn't get an expert, they dropped a speedy trial motion. So it indicates the gamesmanship and the strategy that the appellant employed at trial, which should this, so while he did make demands, it should weigh little in his favor. And then I'll just conclude with pointing to the prejudice prong. First, there's not been any indication to the impact of this trial, but as far as it goes with the, at least at trial, the defense counsel told the judge that she was concerned that she could not appropriately question these victims. And so I would just point to the record at 971 that the defense actually blistered this witness on cross-exam. And so she carried out the bias she impeached witness. She had her experts on board, at least some of the experts on board up to this point. And then with the military judges chosen remedial action, there was absolutely no impairment of the defense from looking at what actually occurred at trial. And so I understand I have more time, but pending your questions, this case is not the outlier that warrants the interposition of Article 10. And this court could affirm the judgment of the Army Corps.
Thank you, counsel. Do any judges have other questions? If not, thank you, counsel. And the appellant is recognized for rebuttal.
No questions, Your Honor.
Okay. Does the appellant waive rebuttal?
Counsel, do you have any further argument that you would like to make to the court? Or do you rest on your brief and what you said in your initial argument?
Or can you not hear us? Counsel, for you, are you there?
Yes, sir. I am there, Your Honor. I pushed the wrong button there for a second.
Okay, rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. I would simply make one point in rebuttal to this court, and it is that the government bears the burden of proof on Article 10 motions, and so to the extent that the record is incomplete or missing things, that weighs against them on Issue 1 and demonstrates the lack of completeness under Issue 2. Pending this court's questions.
Are there any further questions for the appellant? If not, thank you. The court thanks counsel for both sides.